Chapter 2. Tertia Optio. 6 months passed. One night, in April 1946, America's ambassador to the Soviet Union, General Walter Bedell Smith, was riding in his chauffeur-driven limousine headed to the Kremlin, where he was set to meet with Joseph Stalin. Tempered yet tenacious, the former general was a man well-versed in military operations. During the war, Bedell Smith served as Eisenhower's chief of staff. Wartime colleagues called him Ike's hatchet man. General Eisenhower called him the greatest general manager of the war. An all-round intimidating figure, Bedell Smith was rarely one to express unease, and yet here he was, feeling apprehensive about what lay ahead. He served as President Truman's top diplomat now, and the issue at hand was how not to go to war with the Soviet Union. I believed myself more or less immune to excitement, but I must confess I experienced a feeling of tension as the hour for the interview approached, Bedell Smith later recalled. I thought the meeting might be a stormy one. World War II had been over for less than a year, and already Stalin was the new nemesis of the Western world. Stalin was paranoid and power mad. As premier of the Soviet Union, he ruled by terror. Since his rise to power in the early 1920s, he'd starved and killed millions of his own people and personally oversaw the assassination of rivals who threatened him, including Leon Trotsky, an early architect of the Soviet state, whom he had ordered to be killed in Coyoacan, Mexico in 1940. Stalin assassinated writers and philosophers unwilling to peddle propaganda, and scientists and engineers who failed to solve his technology problems. In 1937, he had 8 of his top army generals executed in the Great Purge. During World War II, he had been one of America's most powerful allies, which made it necessary to look beyond his crimes and win the war. Now, from the perspective of the State Department officials to whom Walter Bedell Smith reported, Joseph Stalin was no longer behaving as a friend. The U.S. Embassy car moved quickly down Arbat Street, through the soot-stained snow, the American flags attached to its antennae whipping in the night air. This route to the Kremlin was along one of the most heavily policed streets in the world, but because the car's occupants enjoyed diplomatic privileges, it never had to stop. All the traffic lights remained green as Bedell Smith's driver hurtled along. Sitting alone in the back seat, the ambassador read and reread pages of notes prepared for him by the State Department. Possible points to be stressed in conversation with Stalin, its header read. Just a few days prior, Bedell Smith's charge d'affaires at the embassy in Moscow, a career diplomat named George Keenan, had advised President Truman on the threat posed by Stalin in what would become known as the Long Telegram. Stalin knew only the logic of force, Keenan said. The Soviets were on the move, devouring territory around the globe. The United States had only one option. Stalin had to be stopped. Bedell Smith's mission was to find out how much more land Stalin intended to grab. To look at a map made the problem self-evident. Russia's human losses in World War II had been colossal, with some 20 million dead. But more troubling for the West were its territorial gains. During the war, Stalin's Red Army took possession of almost half of Europe, then kept much of it after the Nazis capitulated. In 1946, power came in numbers. Military strength was still about a nation's potential army size. The U.S. population was around 140 million. Stalin ruled over 200 million Russians and another 100 million people living beyond the country's traditional borders in the land that had been grabbed. To make matters even more threatening, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR, was getting bigger by the season. The question Bedell Smith needed answered was simple but uncomfortable. How much further was Stalin going to go? The embassy car deposited Bedell Smith at the Kremlin's main gate, and the ambassador was taken inside to Stalin's personal office building. Bedell Smith was escorted up to the third floor, down a long, austere corridor, and into a high-ceilinged, wood-paneled conference room. There sat Stalin, his back to the wall, facing Bedell Smith as he entered. Behind the dictator hung massive oil portraits depicting the great Russian marshals, most of them on horseback. Bedell Smith spotted Suvorov and Kutuzov, two military strategists noted for their expansionist views. Once seated, Bedell Smith spoke first through an interpreter. He discussed the most pressing issues from his State Department notes, watching Stalin as he took exaggerated draws on a long, thin cigarette. By the time Bedell Smith finished talking, Stalin had picked up a red pencil and begun writing. Points to later debate, Bedell Smith first assumed. But upon closer inspection, it was clear that Joseph Stalin was doodling. The ambassador was stunned. His drawings, repeated many times, looked to me like lopsided hearts done in red, with a small question mark in the middle. Stalin entered the conversation by making a point about oil, Iranian oil. "You don't understand our situation with regards to oil and Iran," Stalin said, suggesting that he could answer the ambassador's questions with a singularly cryptic point. "The Baku oil fields are our major source of supply. We are not going to risk our oil supply. The Soviet Union needed a greater share in the exploitation of the world's oil," Stalin said, "and the competition for these resources was a significant point of contention between Russia and the United States." As Bedell Smith considered his response, Stalin took the opportunity to bring up a more personal matter. Lately, Great Britain and the United States had been teaming up against Russia and placing obstacles in her path, Stalin said. Bedell Smith was caught off guard. Did Stalin really believe that the United States and Great Britain are united in an alliance to thwart Russia? He asked. "Da," Stalin replied in a long, slow breath. "Yes. I must affirm, in the strongest possible terms, that is not the case," the U.S. ambassador insisted. Except it was true. British Prime Minister Churchill had stated as much just 1 month before, during a speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. "An iron curtain has descended across the European continent," Churchill famously declared. "From Warsaw to Berlin, all these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere, and all are subject, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and, in many cases, increasing measure of control from Moscow." Churchill had compared Stalin to a puppet master. This infuriated Stalin. Like most tyrants, he resented any person who suggested that his popularity was based not on adoration, but fear. Stalin had hated Churchill for decades. In 1919, Churchill tried to instigate war against Russia and persuaded the United States to join him in an armed occupation against parts of our territory, Stalin reminded Ambassador Bedell Smith, adding, "Lately, he's been at it again." Stalin called the Westminster speech an unfriendly act and said that it was an unwarranted attack upon the USSR. He pointed out that the United States would never stand by passively if such an insult was hurled in its direction. But Russia, as the events of the past few years have proved, is not stupid, Stalin forewarned. We can recognize our friends from our potential enemies. Ambassador Bedell Smith was in a bind. He needed an answer for President Truman, so he asked Stalin directly, "How far is Russia going to go?" Stalin paused, stopped doodling the red hearts and the question marks. Looking directly at Walter Bedell Smith, he replied in a monotone, "We're not going to go much further." But what exactly did "much further" mean? That was the enigma of 1946. Stalin ended the interview and the ambassador was shown the door. 11 months later, the United States drew a line in the sand, declaring communism the enemy of democracy. On March 12, 1947, in a dramatic speech to a joint session of Congress, President Truman warned the American people that Moscow had to be stopped. "It must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation," Truman said. Without American help, darkness and cataclysm would descend in the world, and disorder might well spread throughout the entire Middle East. In a display of near unanimous support, the members of Congress took to their feet. For 2 minutes, President Truman enjoyed his first standing ovation since the end of the war. The speech marked the beginning of the Truman Doctrine, American foreign policy designed to confront and counter Soviet geopolitical expansion. Congress passed the National Security Act of 1947, restructuring the U.S. military and intelligence agencies and creating a national security apparatus for the modern era. The act officially established the Central Intelligence Agency and the White House National Security Council, NSC, and it gave way to an unconventional warfare division for the president to command, on his authority and his alone. This unit was designed to be covert. George Kennan called it a guerrilla warfare corps for the commander-in-chief. Covert action would become the president's hidden hand, visible only to those in his inner circle. The National Security Council directed the CIA to take control of these hidden hand operations, officially called covert action operations, under Title 50 authority of the U.S. Code. The Department of Defense would work under a separate authority called Title 10, which outlines the role of the armed forces. This distinction remains in effect today. During a National Security Council meeting in December of 1947, the president's advisors clarified that the CIA's covert action authority would include preventative direct action through paramilitary activities as a means of countering the vicious covert activities of the USSR. Direct action would become a key phrase at the CIA, one that allowed its officers and operators Title 50 authority not available to anyone else in the United States unless expressly directed by the president. The CIA's general counsel, Lawrence Houston, requested clarification. How much autonomy would the CIA have in conducting these covert action operations? Lack of such specific direction may be considered a weakness in the National Security Act of 1947 that deserves further consideration by the Congress, Houston wrote. The following month, National Security Council Directive 10-2, NSC 10-2, provided the clarification Houston had sought. A new office would be created inside the CIA called the Office of Special Projects, where covert actions would be planned and executed in peacetime. In times of war, the CIA was to coordinate its covert operations with the Defense Department and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Covert operations are understood to be all activities which are conducted or sponsored by this government against hostile foreign states or groups, according to the directive, but which are so planned and executed that if uncovered, the U.S. government can plausibly disclaim any responsibility for them. While the concept of willful ignorance has insulated countless commanders and kings from embarrassment and scandal, it was in this moment that the President's National Security Council made the concept of plausible deniability an official construct. Plausible deniability would hereafter allow U.S. presidents to say they didn't know. For the first time in American history, the president had at his disposal a secret paramilitary organization authorized by Congress to carry out hidden hand operations to protect U.S. national security interests around the world. Before NSC 10-2, there were two ways in which U.S. foreign policy and national security were pursued. The first option was diplomacy, the second, war. Covert action was now the president's third option, or tertia optio, after diplomacy failed and a Title X military operation was deemed unwise. On September 1, 1948, the Office of Special Projects changed its name to the more innocuous-sounding Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, and got to work. The new organization's activities might well enhance possibilities for achieving American objectives by means short of war, said George Kennan, co-architect of NSC 10-2, along with James Forrestal, the nation's first Secretary of Defense. According to a report written by the National Security Council, kept classified for 55 years, the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination would now be responsible for covert action paramilitary operations including guerrilla movements, underground armies, sabotage, and assassination. In its first 2 years of existence, the CIA's covert operations concentrated on anti-communist partisan groups in Europe and the Eastern Bloc. Then, on June 25, 1950, the unthinkable happened. The Army of North Korea, backed by Soviet tanks and Chinese intelligence, invaded South Korea with the goal of reuniting the divided country under communist rule. The entire Western world was caught off guard. The CIA had failed to foresee an attack that the U.S. national security apparatus feared could be the opening salvo of World War III. The United Nations called upon the invading communist troops to cease fighting and withdraw to the 38th parallel. When the invaders refused, the UN Security Council looked to its members for help. I have ordered United States air and sea forces to give the Korean government troops cover and support, President Truman announced from the White House press room. After just 5 years of peace, the country was at war again. Behind the lines, paramilitary operations were needed to augment conventional forces. The CIA surged ahead with plans to take the lead. Chapter 3. Surprise Attack in Korea. That the nation's new intelligence agency had failed to anticipate the invasion of an ally by communist forces put the CIA in a compromised position. President Truman blamed leadership and decided that CIA Director Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter had to go. To replace him, he called upon General Walter Bedell Smith, who was physically unwell. The stress of having served as ambassador to Moscow had left Bedell Smith with a severe ulcer, and he'd recently undergone major surgery at Walter Reed to have two-thirds of his stomach removed. President Truman had previously offered him the job as CIA director, a position he had graciously turned down. Now, with the United States at war in Korea, President Truman's request became an order, and Bedell Smith became the new director of the CIA. With a formidable figure now at the helm, the CIA's credibility and access to resources dramatically expanded. According to CIA documents kept classified for nearly 50 years, Korea became a testing ground for the support of conventional warfare with unconventional efforts, or black operations, behind enemy lines. Walter Bedell Smith had no experience in covert operations, so he looked to outside experts. He chose them unwisely, he later learned. With black operations now at the fore, the CIA called upon the experience and talents of the Office of Strategic Services, dismantled by Truman in October 1945. Its members had hardly disappeared from public service. At the start of the Korean War, one-third of the CIA's total personnel had previously served in the OSS. "I know nothing about this business," Bedell Smith confided to Admiral Sidney Sewers, the CIA's first director. "I need a deputy who does." For the job of deputy director of plans, a euphemism for director of covert operations, he chose veteran OSS officer and future CIA director Alan Dulles. In turn, Dulles filled the positions below him with veterans of the OSS. Frank Wisner, formerly the OSS station chief in Romania, assumed responsibility for Office of Policy Coordination Operations and Staff. Wisner, or Wiz, as he was known among colleagues, was a complex individual obsessed with rolling back Soviet gains. A former Olympic runner, he was now overweight and out of shape from years of heavy drinking and womanizing. He was under pressure from the FBI for having had a wartime affair with a Romanian princess suspected of being a Soviet spy. His mercurial behavior was written off by colleagues and family alike as part of his personality. "He seemed to be only half with us, always pondering some insoluble riddle," said his son Graham. Nevertheless, he dominated every conversation with an extraordinary mixture of wit, charm, humor, and Southern power. What no one knew at the time was that Frank Wisner was in the early stages of mental illness and would eventually end his own life with a shotgun blast in the mouth. For now, he was in charge of planning and overseeing paramilitary action in Korea, sending hundreds, perhaps thousands, of good men to their deaths. The black mark he left on the agency still haunts the CIA today. Walter Bedell Smith mistrusted Frank Wisner, but he was stuck with him. In Korea, Wisner and his team began planning covert action operations. One of the first was an operation to infiltrate an agent into Pyongyang to assassinate North Korea's communist dictator, Kim Il-sung. The operation was so sensitive it was personally handled by Wisner's deputy chief of CIA covert operations, a former OSS officer named Hans V. Toft. The enigmatic Hans Toft was an American citizen born in Denmark. At first glance, he appeared highly qualified for the job. Fluent in Japanese, Russian, and Chinese, he had lived overseas in his 20s and been recruited by the British Secret Intelligence Services in the early years of the war. When the OSS was created, Toft was assigned to its Special Operations Division. He had trained Jedburgh candidates Bill Casey and Aaron Bank in guerrilla warfare at Area B. Inserted into the war theater by parachute, he fought the Nazis behind enemy lines in Italy and Yugoslavia with valor. The King of Denmark knighted him. But like Frank Wisner, something had happened to Hans Toft in the 5 years since the end of World War II. His character transformed. By 1950, Toft was a liar and a thief. Was it post-traumatic stress? Hubris? Too much booze? The danger of covert action operations and the plausible deniability construct in which they exist was that it made it possible for ignoble actions to be easily concealed. Like Frank Wisner, Toft would ultimately experience a tragic downfall. Fired from the CIA for stealing classified information, he would die impoverished, his reputation in ruins. But for now, as deputy chief of CIA covert operations in Korea, Toft was in charge of running the assassination plot to kill Korean President Kim Il-sung. To do this, he oversaw 6 CIA operators who worked out of a hotel room in Tokyo. There were classified reasons why the CIA feared Kim Il-sung. To the intelligence community, he was the most dangerous kind of despot, a Soviet puppet. The CIA believed Kim Il-sung to be a top-ranking traitor who isn't even who he said he is, according to a dossier entitled The Identity of Kim Il-sung. The man's real name was Kim Sung-joo, analysts concluded. Orphaned as a child, he was said to have killed a fellow student while in high school. The circumstances of the murder were chronicled in his CIA file. Needing money, he stole it from a classmate, was caught, and fearing possible disclosure, killed his classmate, the dossier read. It was around this time that the orphan Kim Sung-joo was identified by communist intelligence agents as someone the party could blackmail into use. The real Kim Il-sung had been a genuine war hero, a courageous guerrilla fighter who'd battled Japanese invaders in the Paektu mountain regions of Korea during World War II. According to information in the CIA dossier, Stalin's assassins killed the war hero and disappeared him. This enabled Stalin's minions to steal the war hero's identity and give it to the orphan boy with a caveat. The imposter Kim Il-sung would now act as Moscow's puppet. In the fall of 1945, when Stalin appointed a man named Kim Il-sung to be Secretary General of the North Korea Communist Party, the identity theft was complete. Specific instructions were given to the leaders of that regime that there should be no questions raised about Kim Il-sung's identity, the CIA learned. If the story were indeed true, North Korea's leader was an exceptionally dangerous kind of tyrant, fundamentally beholden to the Kremlin. If Kim Il-sung did not do exactly as instructed by the Politburo, his background as a murderous orphan, not a war hero, could be revealed. North Korea was one of the poorest countries in the world, and Kim Il-sung was dependent upon Russian patronage for his country's most basic needs. Everything he did was now in service to his communist masters, including the siege and subsequent land grab of South Korea. The CIA's Office of Policy Coordination put North Korean President Kim Il-sung at the top of one of its earliest known targeted kill lists. Hans Toft received a cable from Washington. An assassin had been chosen for the job. Toft was to receive the CIA covert action operator in Tokyo, then oversee his infiltration into Pyongyang. The man was a Cherokee Indian codenamed Buffalo, Toft told historian Joseph Goulden after the war, as had Reinhard Heydrich's assassins, Jan Kubisch and Josef Gabczak. Buffalo had volunteered for the job. He'd been asked in Washington, "How would you like to kill Kim Il-sung?" And he had accepted the mission with great pride, Toft recalled. Toft received instructions to meet the assassins near the wall of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo at sunset, at a designated time on a specific day. Carrying a briefcase full of cash from his office's unvouchered funding authority, Toff handed over a considerable amount of money to Buffalo, he later recalled. The mission failed, he says, and Buffalo was never heard from again. The idea that a Native American Indian, an assassin for the CIA, could simply make his way to Pyongyang in the middle of a war and blend in among the locals there was ambitious and foolhardy. It also set a precedent for what would eventually become known as lethal direct action, targeted killing, directed against a specific person either in peacetime or war. While the Hague Resolution prohibited assassination, Title 50, Covert Action Authority, made targeted killing legal, intended to counter the vicious covert activities of the USSR. The fabricated identity of Kim Il-sung was a case in point, a Soviet covert act of deception directed against the United States. Through North Korea's supreme commander, Stalin could entangle the United States in a war on the Korean Peninsula. The Office of Policy Coordination began inserting CIA paramilitary teams deep inside Korea, behind enemy lines. The teams, led by Americans and made up of anti-communist Korean and Chinese nationals, were airdropped into hostile territory to conduct sabotage and subversion, including hit-and-run assassinations, similar to what OSS had done during World War II. The results were disastrous, as explained by the man assigned to lead the CIA's parachute infiltration efforts, a former OSS Jedburgh named John Jack Singlob. In 2016, Singlob, age 96, recalled these wartime tragedies with clarity and stoicism. One of the impossible imperatives of war in Asia was that Westerners could never simply disappear behind enemy lines into the civilian populations, as we had done in Nazi-occupied Europe, Singlob said. This was a tremendous challenge in Korea and an equally difficult problem in Vietnam. He was referring to the future war in which he would also play a significant role, running covert action operations for the CIA. Singlob would rise to the position of U.S. Army Major General. In 1951, Jack Singlob served as CIA Deputy Chief of Station in Seoul. He and his colleagues worked out of the newly renovated Traymore Hotel downtown. Their cover was that they were an advisory organization called the Special Operations Group, SOG, Joint Advisory Commission Korea, JAC, 8132nd Army Unit. The cover name paid homage to the OSS Special Operations Branch, and the unit became known simply as Jack. Jack's first commander, Singlob's boss, was the CIA's chief of station in Seoul, Ben Vandervoort, a legendary paratroop commander who'd lost one eye fighting Nazis in Holland. A month after Singlob arrived, Vandervoort was called back to Washington, much to Singlob's dismay. His replacement was a former CIA operative and Army colonel named Albert R. Haney, a man whose integrity would also come under fire, as had Wisner's and Toff's. Following a blueprint created by the OSS, the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination sought to organize an anti-communist guerrilla force it could train and equip for partisan warfare behind enemy lines in Korea. OPC officers combed through refugee camps in South Korea, looking for local fighters qualified for paramilitary service, including North Korean and Chinese nationals. Back in America, dozens of college graduates were being recruited by the CIA to lead these covert action operations in the Far East. One of the recruits was Donald P. Gregg, who was studying cryptanalysis, the study of hidden information systems, at a liberal arts college in Massachusetts. Gregg would eventually work for the CIA for 31 years. Gregg and dozens of other new officers in training were sent to a clandestine irregular warfare facility run by the CIA on the island of Saipan, a tiny dot in the Pacific Ocean 2,000 miles southeast of Seoul. There, hundreds of young male Korean and Chinese refugees recruited from war camps underwent weeks of training in guerrilla warfare tactics. "We were following in the footsteps of the OSS," says Gregg, who later became U.S. ambassador to South Korea. But unlike veteran covert action officer Jack Singlob, Don Gregg had no experience fighting wars, let alone using unconventional warfare tactics behind enemy lines. He'd only recently graduated from Williams College and barely knew where Korea was on the map. "We didn't know what we were doing," he says of his experiences on Saipan. "I asked my superiors what the mission was, but they wouldn't tell me. They didn't know. We were training Koreans and Chinese and a lot of strange people," Gregg recalled. The problem facing the CIA in Korea was twofold. Who exactly were the indigenous forces the agency was training? And could it be assumed that they, too, were in pursuit of American goals? A great majority spoke no English. An equal number were illiterate. How could the CIA identify a traitor under such circumstances? How would anyone know if a recruit or volunteer was in fact a spy sent by the North Korean People's Army or the Internal Security Forces? Jack Singlob had his own set of worries, more practical than theoretical. His OPC colleagues, Frank Wisner and Hans Toft, were anxious to begin airdropping teams of CIA operators and their local forces into North Korea behind enemy lines. As the man overseeing air insertion tactics, Singlob felt this pressure. He also worried about getting the men safely into the war zone. "The Chinese were well aware of our airdrop operations and had learned to recognize the sound of low-flying transport planes that had an open door," he recalls. Singlob felt it would be safer to airdrop the operators into enemy territory from higher up. This would give them a greater chance of successful clandestine insertion, he believed. CIA covert action operations were being run out of a forward operating base, FOB, on Yeongdo Island in southwestern Korea, and it was there that Singlob began testing his new idea. "Parachuting was my specialty from the OSS Jedburgh days," he recalls. He borrowed a B-26 light bomber aircraft from the Air Force, re-rigged the bomb bay as a jump platform, and went out for a test. "I told the pilot to keep his airspeed close to normal for level flight, then jumped, assuming the same position I'd used to jump into Nazi-occupied France. Once he was out of the aircraft, he pulled his parachute and floated down to the ground. The test demonstrated we could use bombers for agent drops, he says. The success sparked another idea, a way to get a team in even more secretly. What if, he thought, instead of pulling his ripcord right away, he instead allowed his body to fall through the air, reaching terminal velocity, roughly 122 miles per hour, or 54 meters per second, and then pull. This was long before the days of skydiving, back when the military had very clear protocols about how its paratroopers jumped, Singlob clarifies. What he wanted to do now was free fall, then pull his ripcord, say, 1,000 feet above the ground. While inherently more dangerous than a static line jump, free-falling meant the enemy was less likely to see an agent's parachute as he floated to Earth. To test this idea, Singlob borrowed an L-19 bird dog from the Air Force. Accompanied by airborne specialist Captain John Skip Sadler, he made a series of test jumps, leaping out of the aircraft and having Sadler record the time before his parachute blossomed. After each test, Singlob waited longer on the next jump, thereby getting closer to the ground each successive time. Objects on the ground came into sharp focus within 1,000 feet or so. I watched an object on the road below change from a blurred dot to what looked like a child's toy to an actual U.S. Army Jeep with a white star stenciled on its hood. I pulled the ripcord. Singlob's parachute opened and his feet hit the sand. Neither of us realized at the time that we'd invented the concept of high-altitude, low-opening, HALO, parachute drops right there over the Han River in Korea. The HALO jump has since become the most effective means of inserting covert action operators into denied territory and behind enemy lines. In 2019, it is still the method of choice. In Washington, D.C., a battle over covert action operations was underway between the CIA and the U.S. Army. When war broke out on the Korean Peninsula, there was no Special Operations Forces, SOF, capability at the Defense Department. The military response was hesitant, skeptical, indifferent, and even antagonistic with regard to all aspects of unconventional or irregular warfare, says retired colonel and U.S. Army historian Alfred H. Paddock, Jr. Most military leaders at the Pentagon wanted no part of these ungentlemanly black operations. Guerrilla warfare was frowned upon, says Singlob. There were two notable exceptions. Leading a small group of guerrilla warfare pioneers inside the military establishment in 1951 were General Robert A. McClure, former director of the Psychological Warfare Division during World War II, and Colonel Russell W. Volkman, a former U.S. Army captain who'd led the only non-OSS guerrilla operations during the war in the Philippines. What gave General McClure and Colonel Volkman momentum in their efforts was that both men had the ear of their former boss, General Eisenhower, now serving as the U.S. Army Chief of Staff. As per National Security Council Directive 10-2, covert action was to be the sole responsibility of the CIA during peacetime. Korea was different. This was war, McClure and Volkman agreed. To me, the military has the inherent responsibility in time of war to organize and conduct special forces operations, Volkman told his commanding general. I feel that it is unsound, dangerous, and unworkable to delegate these responsibilities to a civil agency, that is, the CIA. General McClure took a similar position. I believe the Army should be the executive agent for guerrilla activities, he told the Army Chief of Staff, I am not going to fight with CIA as to their responsibility in those fields. In an attempt to alleviate the conflict, the Joint Chiefs of Staff created an army organization to work with Jack called CCRAC. In CCRAC documents located in the National Archives, the organization's original acronym is revealed: Covert, Clandestine, and Related Activities in Korea, an on-the-nose description of the U.S. Army's secret guerrilla warfare unit in Korea. As happened at the CIA, the name was quickly changed to something more innocuous. CCRAC became Combined Command Reconnaissance Activities, Korea. An operations base was set up on Pyongyang Island off the coast of South Korea near the northern limit line. The unit assigned to work with the CIA's JAC was originally called the Guerrilla Section, 8th Army Miscellaneous, but this name was also deemed too revealing. It was changed to the United Nations Partisan Infantry, Korea. That the Army was vying for power over covert operations infuriated the CIA's Frank Wisner. The CIA informed the Department of Defense of its displeasure. Mr. Wisner, as head of OPC, would like it to be clearly understood that this understanding is reached on the assumption that the Army is creating a Special Forces Training Command for its own purposes and not at the request of CIA, agency officials wrote in a now declassified memo. Theirs was a temporary wartime gesture of cooperation. The CIA is not going to place itself in the position of giving the Army an excuse to justify the creation of its own unconventional warfare capability. Once the war was over, agency officials demanded that covert action authority be returned to the CIA. The aversion to risk was perhaps the single greatest discrepancy between the CIA and the Pentagon. The CIA was about taking chances. Its officers and operators were trained to act as the president's hidden hand. Covert action operations are meant to remain forever hidden from public scrutiny. In the event one becomes known, plausible deniability becomes the goal. At the opposite end of the spectrum is the U.S. military, an organization that follows strict procedures and protocols. Its classified and clandestine operations might be kept secret for a period of time, but eventually they are meant to be revealed. One of the biggest obstacles I faced in Korea, says Singlob, was the Pentagon's worry that these paramilitary units might be captured, broken by physical and psychological torture, and turned against us for propaganda purposes. Unlike CIA officers, the Pentagon's soldiers are not explicitly trained how to lie. Jack and CCRAC's guiding principles were, however, ultimately the same. Each organization was born of the OSS, with foundations in guerrilla warfare. A manual entitled Psy War 040 CIA was given to both sets of operators to study and learn from. Hit and run, these are guerrilla's tactics, its authors explained. Primary objective, the killing and capture of personnel. Sniping and demolitions. Initiative and aggressiveness tempered by calm judgment will be encouraged. Avoid trying to win the war by yourself. Colonel Douglas C. Dillard, a 26-year-old infantry officer from Georgia, was put in charge of delivery and resupply of these joint CIA-Army airborne operations, codenamed Aviary. Their missions were kept classified until 2009. Although some took place early in the Korean War, the scale of operations rose dramatically starting in February of 1952. One of Aviary's first missions ended in disaster, Colonel Diller recalled in 2009. It was the winter of 1952, a period of time known as the Second Korean Winter, now 20 months into the war. A dismal lull had settled over the battlefield, with fighting diminished to violent, small-unit clashes and struggles over key outpost positions along the front lines of Korea's hilly landscape. Hundreds of Americans had been captured and were being kept under brutal conditions inside POW camps. The joint CIA-Army mission on the night of February 18, 1952, was designed to airdrop paramilitary operators who would gather reconnaissance on a POW camp and then exfiltrate by ground. The missions were dangerous. Territory above the 38th parallel was notoriously inhospitable. Unlike with OSS Jedburgh airdrops into France, there'd be a very limited greeting party on the ground, maybe one or two anti-communist partisan agents. Radio communication did not exist in the outer reaches of this landscape, so agents were dropped in with homing pigeons strapped to their legs. This was often their only means of communicating with their CIA and U.S. Army handlers in the South, a single homing pigeon to let the handler know they'd made it safely in. The rate of return was incredibly low, recalls CIA historian John P. Finnegan. New tradecraft techniques were constantly being developed and tested. On this mission, the covert action operators wore enemy uniforms and carried Chinese-made weapons. They could impersonate enemy patrols and, if necessary, shoot their way back to UN lines, Dillard explained. But there was a much bigger problem facing the unit. One everyone knew about and few wanted to discuss, says Singlob. How do you trust that the indigenous agents you are paying will not try and kill you? A traitor in the ranks almost certainly meant death. It was the early morning hours of February 19, 1952, and Air Force Captain Lawrence E. Berger was piloting a C-47 south of Wonsan, North Korea. There were two missions on deck, both covert action operations, both parachute infiltrations of American, Korean, and Chinese national paramilitary teams behind enemy lines. Given the limits on usable aircraft, it was common to run more than one mission per flight. Master Sergeant Davis T. Harrison stood in the door with the four anti-communist Chinese agents he was running, preparing them for a static line jump. The partisans had been culled from a refugee camp down south and trained for action by CIA paramilitary officers. They all stood in the doorway, ready to jump. Three of the Chinese guerrilla fighters were big. One was small. Each man stood the proper distance from the next, ripcords attached to the static line. It was best to have the smallest man jump first, Sergeant Harrison later told a military investigation board. But this particular man made such a fuss about jumping out last, and the situation gave Harrison pause. But Harrison didn't speak Chinese, and the partisan agent didn't speak English, an ongoing problem with covert operations inside Jack. The general rule in these kinds of intense moments was to be flexible. Think fast. Seated inside the aircraft, Sergeant Harrison observed Private First Class Dean H. Crabb, his fellow covert action operator. Crabb was seated next to the four anti-communist guerrilla fighters working under his authority. The team would be making the next jump even deeper behind enemy lines, almost 100 miles north of what was about to be the first airdrop. It was 1:45 a.m., pitch dark outside and well below zero. Sergeant Harrison scanned the ground down below for a sign. The way signaling worked out there was that when anti-communist partisans on the ground heard the airplane approach, they would ignite small fires inside metal buckets to briefly illuminate the drop zone. Harrison stared down into the darkness below. The snow was fierce, There were big winds, freezing temperatures, and the threat of anti-aircraft fire from enemy forces on the ground. At last, he spotted a faint cluster of signal fires. Harrison alerted the pilot, Captain Berger. The mission was now a go. Captain Berger banked the aircraft and made a wide circle, lowering his altitude as the CIA's aviary team prepared to jump. The first Chinese partisan moved to the door. Harrison gave the rebel fighter the go-ahead to jump and watched as the man leapt out into the air. The second man quickly jumped. When the third man hesitated, Harrison knew intuitively that something was terribly wrong. Instead of jumping, the man reached into his pocket and pulled out a grenade. He yanked the pin, rolled it into the seating area of the aircraft, and leapt out into the night air. Davis T. Harrison was instantly blown out of the aircraft. Assistant Jump Master Corporal George Tatarakis was also jettisoned from the burning plane. Dean Crabb and his team of four Chinese partisans were killed instantly by shrapnel and blast. Captain Berger struggled with the crippled aircraft, ordering his six-man crew to bail out while he worked to keep the aircraft steady. The men, later identified as Rodin, Layer, King, Dick, and Haley, somehow managed to bail out. Captain Berger stayed at the controls of the airplane until it crashed into a mountain range below. Master Sergeant Davis Harrison and Corporal George Tatarakis, both wearing parachutes, pulled their ripcords before hitting the ground. Both landed safely, as did five members of the crew. Everyone but Harrison was captured by the North Korean army. Harrison evaded capture for 24 hours, sneaking into a house and asking for help. The family offered him sanctuary, but while he was sleeping, notified the North Korean army, which came and took Harrison away. Each of the covert action operators and the air crew died or were killed in POW camps in the north. Harrison's body was repatriated after the war. The mission was but one of dozens of disastrous operations, all kept classified for decades, the great majority of which amounted to a tragic intelligence failure. Thousands of anti-communist foreign fighters and their American handlers were dropped into North Korea, never to return. These were suicide missions, concluded Peter Seichel, CIA station chief in Hong Kong. Many of the operatives recruited by the Office of Policy Coordination from refugee camps turned out to be double agents. If program organizers Frank Wisner, Hans Toft, and Albert Haney were naive to the double cross in the beginning, declassified documents make clear that as early as 8 months into the war, they understood what was going on. Their intelligence was thin, spurious or feigned. But the trio continued winging it, sending volunteer operators to their graves. They reported mission success instead of abject failure. The result was the loss of what the CIA now concedes amounted to hundreds, perhaps thousands, of lives. At the Pentagon, General McClure and Colonel Volkmann blew the whistle internally. But the damage could, of course, not be undone. The experience transformed McClure's reservations into outright suspicions about the CIA's motives, wrote Alfred Paddock. Hans Toft was replaced in Korea by career CIA officer John L. Hart. Upon reviewing classified documents that Toft kept in his office, Hart became outraged and notified CIA Director Walter Bedell Smith. The results of our investigation surpassed our most pessimistic expectations, he later explained. Countless intelligence reports merely fabricated by people living in Seoul. Bedell Smith sent his deputy, Loftus Becker, to Seoul to tell the CIA's John Hart that the agency could not afford a scandal. With its reputation not yet established, Becker told Hart the CIA simply could not admit to other branches of government, least of all to the highly competitive U.S. military intelligence services, its inability to collect intelligence on North Korea. Hart's reports were classified. So were Operation Aviary's catastrophic losses. Devastated by the deception, Loftus Becker resigned. The North Korean covert action operations would remain a secret failure for decades. Haney, Toft, and Wisner moved on to a new covert action operation, this time in Guatemala. The CIA had failed in Korea because it entered the game too late and had no reliable network of agents on the ground. In Guatemala, the plan was to be preemptive, fix things before they happened. This doctrine would become known as regime change. General McClure wrote to his commander, General Charles Bolte, with his analysis of the situation. I would take the opportunity to bring you up to date on the Army-CIA relationship, McClure explained. In recent conferences at CIA, I have heard it said, since we are now a fourth service, many of the activities for which the Army was planning should be transferred to CIA, including the command of military forces designed for guerrilla warfare in time of war. Needless to say, I am very unhappy about it, both because I question the ability of CIA, and second, because I have never believed the Joint Chiefs intended to abrogate their responsibilities for the active command of military operations in time of war. At the CIA, Walter Bedell Smith was also concerned. In a letter to Ludwig Lee Montagu, his advisor on the National Security Council staff, Smith expressed fear that his covert action deputies, Alan Dulles and Frank Wisner, could lead the CIA into some ill-conceived and disastrous misadventure. But the horse was already out of the barn. The CIA's covert action operation budget had expanded to become three times the size of the agency's budgets for intelligence and espionage combined. It was a catch-22. The CIA needed to train and equip partisans in order to form a guerrilla warfare corps on the ground. This underground army was a necessary component in supplying the CIA with intelligence that would keep its agents from being killed. But in reality, the amount of intelligence that could be garnered from inside a totalitarian state like North Korea was close to nil. The possibility of recruiting and running any such sources was as improbable as placing resident spies on the planet Mars, lamented former OSS officer Richard Helms, Frank Wisner's deputy and a future director of Central Intelligence. Bedell Smith considered curtailing the CIA's covert action operations. Too many paramilitary operations pose a distinct danger to CIA as an intelligence agency, he told his staff. Something had to change, or, he feared, the covert action operational tail will wag the intelligence dog. But Bedell Smith was fiercely loyal to the agency that he was in charge of, and in a letter to the National Security Council on the subject of covert action, he conveyed a far less dramatic position. At certain times in the past, we have been importuned by General McClure's people to provide them with detailed information concerning guerrilla groups of which we may have some knowledge, he wrote. We have consistently declined to furnish this information to General McClure because the information requested impinges directly upon secret operations in which we are currently engaged and for which, at this time, we are solely responsible. In his summary, Bedell Smith played the secrecy card. In a CIA analysis of its Korean War operations, kept classified for 50 years, the agency made it clear that it understood its paramilitary operations to be not only ineffective, but probably morally reprehensible in the number of lives lost. The aviary missions were doomed from the start, it concluded. The CIA had no reliable way to discern its enemies from its friends. The amount of time and treasure expended was enormously disproportionate to that which was gained. JAK's classified missions in Korea were water under the bridge. By the end of the war, the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination had built an organization capable of executing covert action on a worldwide scale. An untold number of covert action operations would now begin. While JAK and CCRAC were running dangerous black operations behind enemy lines, a traditional war was also being fought by U.S. Army soldiers on the ground. The oft-cited example of this kind of warfare was demonstrated in the trenches of World War I. Korea had become a war of attrition, a military strategy whereby each side wears down the other side through continuous, relentless loss, grinding down the enemy's morale. Like stags fighting with their horns locked, neither side could win. The end foreseen becomes not victory, but collapse. One of the foot soldiers fighting the Korean War of Attrition was Billy Waugh, now a 21-year-old platoon sergeant with the 187th Airborne Regimental Combat Team. He'd earned his wings with the 82nd Airborne, just as he said he would. With his Browning Bar rifle over his shoulder and his army boots laced up tight, Waugh remembers the demoralizing monotony he felt marching across the frozen land bored out of his mind. "I wanted action. I wanted to fight, and I wanted America to win the war." But none of this was happening in his infantry platoon. The war in Korea was not the kind Billy Waugh envisioned for himself. He wanted to win a glorious victory like the one earned against Germany and Japan. In Korea, the first casualty of war Waugh remembers seeing was a half-frozen civilian lying face up, dead, along the side of the road. "We'd march up over one hill with great expectations of meeting the enemy and finally engaging in fierce combat," he remembers. "Instead, from the top of one hill, we'd look down across a treeless landscape, and all we'd see was the next hill. It was trench warfare, the worst, most baseless form of combat. War by grinding down. I wanted to see combat, to be brave under fire." Soon, Waugh would have his wish. During a chance encounter on a train, he'd learn about secret wars being conducted by the U.S. government as covert operations behind enemy lines in what would become known as denied areas. Billy Waugh would spend the next 7 decades, until at least 2011, engaged in or training for direct action, kill or be killed, covert action operations against America's enemies around the globe. He would train and equip guerrilla fighters, lead hit-and-run ambushes, conduct sabotage against enemy infrastructure, and assassinate. Trudging across Korea's stripped and frozen earth, he foresaw none of this. All he knew was that General Sherman seemed about right. The glory of war was moonshine. War, at least this wretched war of attrition in Korea, was hell.